Okay, starting the broadcast. You are live.
Great, thank you, Jonathan. I'm going to open the July 27th Hood River City Council meeting and call it to order. I don't think we had anyone signed up for business from the audience, so our procedure is to sign up ahead of time since we're on Zoom meetings because of COVID-19. And I'm just going to confirm with Rachel, Will, or Jen that we don't have anyone that was going to speak.
Mayor, that's correct.
That's correct. Okay. Thank you so much. So we will go ahead and open the work session. Do we have any agenda additions or corrections?
No, we do not, Mayor.
Okay, great. So our first discussion item, and we have quite a few this evening, so I'm going to try and keep us moving through these. They're all important, but we do need to try and get through all of them, is a council pledge, which was the use of force policies, and there was a council subcommittee that met on those, and so we're going to have a presentation from our chief and Donnie Chalet. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing your name correctly, Donnie, but go ahead.
All right, thank you. Thank you, Mayor. So let me share my screen really quick. Can you all see that?
Yes.
Yes.
So first I want to give everybody a little background on what the Council Pledge Subcommittee is. On the June 22nd City Council meeting, the council approved the mayor's pledge, which was later named the council pledge. And this was the national call for mayors and city council members to look at police use of force policies. And this was after the events in Minneapolis with the death of George Floyd. And our council decided we want to look at our own police department to see if we're doing things the right way and looking at our policies. And the things they wanted to look at were reviewing any police use of force policies, engage the community by including a diverse range of input, experiences, and stories in the review, report the findings back to the community and seek feedback, and reform any use of force policies as needed. The members that were in these meetings, the subcommittee was Mayor Kate McBride, Councilor Rivera, and Councilor Haney, City Manager Rachel Fuller, and Chief Neil Holste, as well as myself, were involved in these meetings and discussions. So before I get too far into it, I want to explain a little bit about what use of force is. There's been a lot of discussion about it on the national level, and there's no precise definition for use of force, but the International Chiefs of Police define it as the amount of effort required by police to compel compliance by an unwilling subject. And on the flip side of that, you have improper force. You have excessive force, which is the force in excess of what people or what a police officer reasonably believes is necessary. And the word reasonably is very key here. If you look at the 1989 Supreme Court decision of Graham versus Connor, they established an objective reasonableness standard for when an officer can legally use force on a suspect and how much force can be used. So the question was whether or not a reasonable officer on the scene faced with the same circumstances would use the same force. So would that officer do the same thing as the officer before them? And there were a few different things that it's a very long explanation, but that's kind of a brief overview of use of force. And to touch on one other thing really, really quickly, there's been a lot of talk about force continuum and why don't we bring back a force continuum? And the answer is that it's really taken a step backwards. The force continuum has not been taught at the academy since, I think, 2005, 2006. And the reason for that was it didn't take into account the totality of the circumstances. And when you really look at something as far as use of force, you have to try to decide, was the use of force reasonable? And what the force continuum would do was, if the individual did this, the officer could go one level higher. And so it wasn't, some cases turned out to not be very reasonable. And so they changed that to just at a reasonable standard. So that's why we don't have a force continuum anymore. And that's why it's not taught at the academy level. It's not a great way to do it. At the bottom here of the page, you'll see a link. That's a great use of force presentation put on by the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. And they're the entity who certifies all police officers. And so it's a good informational segment on what use of force is and how it's being taught at the police academy. So,
Donnie, yeah. I just wanted to add that I did listen to that when they did it live. And if you haven't listened to it, it's only an hour long and it is really good.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, very informational. So this table here shows all of our use of force incidents over the last 9 years. We decided to do 9 years because in 2011, that's when Chief Holstey took over as chief. And I think it's a good overview of the last decade of what we've been doing. So in the green section on the left, you'll see every year between 2011 and 2020. The next column over where it says CFS, that stands for calls for service. And a call for service is anything we do while we're on duty. If we're dispatched to a call, if we are stopping, you know, initiating a traffic stop, stopping to identify somebody, something that looks suspicious, everything goes into our dispatch center. There are notes taken and that creates a call for service. And as you can see in 2011, we had 8,854 calls for service for the year. And out of those 8,854, three resulted in a use of force. And as you can see, we broke down percentages, and we also looked at the race of the person that the force was being used on, as well as the race of the officer, and then any other contributing factors, whether it's drug impairment, intoxication, and mental illness. And from 2011 to 2020, we had 53 times where we had to use force to get somebody in custody or to gain compliance in some way. And about half of those, you can see, were somebody who was intoxicated, drug impaired, or suffered from mental illness. As you look down, the calls for service start to grow. We have, you know, from 2011 to today, we've had anywhere from 12 to 14 officers, give or take. So our number of officers aren't growing, but our calls for service are. And we're just contacting more and more people all the time. And as you can see, in the last 9 years, we've had just under 120,000 calls for service. And if you look at the yellow section here, the race of the person. So in 2011, we had 8,800 calls for service. Three of those resulted in use of force. There was one Hispanic individual and two white individuals that had force used on them. And on the other side, the race of the officer, we had two Hispanic officers and one white officer involved in that. If you look down to the year 2018, I know there will be some questions about why did it, although it doesn't seem like a big number, but why did it jump from 5 or 6 up to 14? And the number of arrests during this time has gone up pretty dramatically. So from 2011, 12, 13, 14, we probably had 500-600 arrests. So that's 500-600 times that we're actually putting our hands on somebody to put handcuffs on them. And as those arrests increase, there's more opportunity for somebody to pull away from us. And that's really what we're looking at when we're looking at 53 of our use of force reports. The majority of them are just somebody pulling their arm away, and we are using an armbar technique where we straighten the arm, push on the shoulder to try to get the arm behind the back so we could put him in handcuffs, or going to the ground with somebody and trying to grab their hand to put it behind their back. You know, if we have to leg sweep them or any way we can try to gain compliance. And the ultimate goal is not to inflict pain, but to gain compliance and to keep the individual safe, to keep the officer safe and everybody around safe. And so out of the 53 use of force reports we had, 7 were taser deployments. And later on, I'll talk about CIS, who is the entity that did our use of force review. And Dave Nelson, the risk manager there, said that was an extremely low number, that in other agencies, 7 might be an average per shift somewhere. So he was pretty surprised that we had so few. The next table I want to show you may be confusing numbers-wise. So this is use of force by type. And this breaks down what exactly we did. If we used, what techniques we used, did we use a taser? Did we use, just physically grabbed a hold of somebody? Did we pepper spray them? As you can see, we've in the last 9 years and even further back, we've never used a baton on anybody. We've never used the carotid control hold, or otherwise known as the choke hold. We've never, I would say pepper spray, that goes back 15 years. Probably I think we only have one officer that carries pepper spray right now, because he chooses to not carry a taser. And we've had no shootings, and as I said, about seven taser deployments, and the rest fall under the physical category. And the physical category is anything with just our hands. If we are bear hugging somebody, if we are grabbing an arm, grabbing a leg, anything we can to physically get control of that person and gain compliance. So I don't want this to be confusing with the last graph that shows, in 2011, we had 3 use of force reports, but now on this graph, it shows 5. Those are just different movements, not necessarily more use of force.
John, can you clarify? So it's a report could include multiple force types?
Yes. Yeah, so for instance, say if somebody's, I tell somebody they're under arrest, they won't put their hand behind their back, and I ask them again and again, you're under arrest, put your hands behind your back. They refuse to do so, I might grab their arm, okay, and start an armbar technique. If that doesn't work, I may switch to another technique, a leg sweep or a taser deployment. So we're just recording everything we did in that one incident. So although it's one incident, we may have 2 or 3 different techniques that we tried to gain compliance from somebody. Does that answer your question, Counselor Saunders?
It does, thank you.
So kind of an overview here, we've had 119,000 calls for service since 2011. And out of those 119,000, we've had 53 use of force reports. Now, when we have a use of force report, there's a regular police report, and then there's additional use of force report that we do. And the use of force report outlines everything that happened, everything that was said, everything that was done, and any injuries to the person, to the officer. So out of those 53 break down to about 1 every 2 months. And for the last 9 years, the percentage has been 0.044%. If you calculate that out, it's 0.0004%. So for every 10,000 calls for service we've had 4 use of force reports, but 4 to 4.5 use of force reports. And as far as complaints we've received, it's been 0. And then this is not to be confused with a regular complaint. We're a police department. We get complaints. Every police department gets complaints. People don't like getting tickets. People don't like getting their car towed. You name it, we'll hear from people if they're unhappy about something. But as far as use of force complaints received, it's been 0. And to talk about our complaint process a little bit, we've heard, well, maybe it's just hard for people to complain. in this day and age, it's not hard at all. And it's, we make it pretty easy for somebody to get a hold of us to, with any concerns they have, they can walk in and fill out a form. They can get the form online. They can email us, they can call us. We have a Facebook, they can get a hold of us. They can call our dispatch center. They can contact an attorney. So the process for making a complaint is relatively easy. And, you know, thankfully we've had zero complaints going back 9 years. And even beyond that, I've been here 17, 18 years, and I couldn't tell you of any use of force complaints we've ever received even during that time. So injuries to the people that we're using force on. Out of the 53, there have been 11 documented injuries. And to break those down, three of those were taser probe removals. And if you're not familiar with a taser probe, it's a little barbed hook that when we shoot a taser probe, there's like a fish line that comes out and two little hooks will hook into the skin. So for liability purposes, we don't remove the probes ourselves. We call the fire department and the ambulance will come down and remove those probes. And it's very small hole there. So it's not, I wouldn't say it's a very, very minor injury if it's even an injury. Minor scrapes and bruises, there have been about six of those. There was one previous injury and one individual who had an asthma attack after a foot chase. And she was transported by ambulance on that. We've also had injuries to our police officers. These include twisted knees, getting kicked in the chest, scrapes and bruises. And all of that is documented as well. So this is a breakdown of who we are as a department. We have an officer who's American Indian. We have an officer who is Black. We have six officers who are Hispanic and nine officers who are white. And it's a really good mix of culture and diversity that we have here. And I think we've done a pretty good job of maintaining some of that diversity here. Does anybody, before we move on, does anybody have any questions about any of the statistics that we've that we just went over?
Okay. I have a question, Donnie. This is
sure.
Tim. With respect to the injuries to the police, do you have a feel for whether those are from mentally ill folks or what the nature of those, or they have drugs or alcohol, or I'm just curious.
You mean when an officer gets injured?
Yeah.
You know, it's hard to say. I could go back and look at everyone and tell you, but it's a lot of times the injuries occur if we have, you know, but we're trying to get a hold of somebody and get control, and we both fall to the ground. We might scrape a knee, we might scrape a knuckle, things like that. I've personally been, punched, kicked, spit on, bit, you name it, and it's probably happened. So it's hard to say whether it's somebody with mental illness or intoxication. It's just kind of a random act, really. And what usually happens, and I say for the bulk of our use of force incidents, is when we are trying to arrest somebody, they'll just pull away and say, you know, not today, I'm not going to jail. And then, you know, you talk about de-escalation, and that's all we do is try to de-escalate situations. We walk into some pretty chaotic situations. We walk into situations that are calm and become chaotic, and we have to try to restore some kind of peace there. So we're trying to talk to these people. We're trying to build a rapport with them. And sometimes we can see it coming, and sometimes it's very spontaneous. I was handcuffing somebody one time, and I've dealt with this person several times, very friendly individual. He'd been drinking that night. And one night I was arresting him for assault. I go to put the handcuffs on him. He just turns and throws a punch. We go to the ground, I cuff him up, and we get up, and he says, I'm sorry, so a lot of times it's just completely random. Other times there have been times where we have had to use force on somebody so that they wouldn't hurt themselves. If we do have somebody who's mentally ill, the way it works is it is our responsibility to assess the person and say, are you a danger to yourself or others? And, or can you not take care of yourself? If they meet that criteria, by statute, we have to take them to a care or a medical facility. So the emergency room is our only option here in Hood River. And once we get that person there, then we call mental health, then they'll come down and assess this person. And sometimes it can take a little while. Sometimes it can take an hour or 2 hours before somebody can get there. And if the person is drug impaired or intoxicated, they have to wait until that person is completely sober to assess them. So, you know, I've heard talk about sending social workers and sending a mental health workers two calls or take 2-9-1-1 calls. And the problem with that is we still end up going in first because the mental health worker and the social worker, they don't want to go somewhere unless it's safe. So we have to go in there, see what's going on, and then call and see if it's appropriate for them to respond. And in Center for Living, they do have a mobile crisis unit now, albeit probably very understaffed. And again, they'll come to the scene, but not without us. So the idea of having them going and taking these calls, I don't know that they're on board with it yet. And if there are mental health workers that want to go out to calls with us, we welcome that. You know, we have, so much training as far as mental illness goes and they're the experts and we'd always love to have an expert with us, but that's not always reality. Are there any other questions about the statistics? I'm going to jump into our policy review now. And we reached out to CIS, which is the entity that insures the city of Hood River. And we had Dave Nelson, who works in risk management, Steve Kramer, who's a litigation attorney, do that review for us and give us their feedback on what they think we need to change or what we're doing right. So we sent them six different policies, any policy relating to use of force, which was the use of force policy, use of force review board policy, handcuffing and restraints, control devices and techniques, tasers, and officer-involved shootings and deaths. So I'll go over the changes we did make. And the packet you received with all of the recommendations from CIS, there is a question, did we follow those all those recommendations? And yes, some of them were reminders. Some of them were things we already had in our policy that we were already doing. And some were changes we made, and I'll go over those changes now. So the policy 300.2.1, which is the duty to intercede or the duty to intervene, this has to do with if as an officer, if you see another officer behaving badly, if you see them using excessive force or doing something that is detrimental, it's our duty to step in and stop them. And in this policy, it talks about that witnessing officer should promptly report these observations to a supervisor. CIS thought that should wasn't a strong enough word, and they think that we should change it to shall and say this person shall report this promptly to a supervisor. And so that that change was made. And along with this, there was a legislative update that took place at the end of June. And part of it was a special session. They spoke a lot about COVID and some about police reform. And some of the issues they discussed have to do with some national events, you know, like the duty to intervene is a big one right now. And as you can see in Minneapolis, the officers that were standing there while another officer was kneeling on George Floyd's neck, why didn't those officers step in and intervene? And I can't answer why they didn't. However, this is saying you will step in and do something about it, and you'll report it. And this House bill says you'll report it no later than 72 hours after witnessing it. It also says that you are to step in and intervene unless you cannot intervene safely. And so there's some discussion about, well, what does that mean if you can't intervene safely? So if, for instance, if there's, if you see an officer with somebody else and the officer's using force, but you can't physically get to them, or it's too dangerous to get to where they are, that could be an example of when an officer cannot intervene safely. So again, we did change the wording to the officer shall report, promptly report any excessive force that they witness to a supervisor. So policy 300.3.4, which is the carotid control hold, also known as a chokehold. This was, a policy that CIS didn't think that we needed. And the chief and I completely agree. It's not a technique that the Academy, DPSST, does not train this technique. It's not anything that we're trained, internally in the department on this technique. So because of that, we decided we don't need it in our policy. It's not something we use. It's not a technique that we have ever used here. But this also did fall under the special legislative session, and House Bill 4203 pretty kind of mirrors what our policy states, that, it's not a justified technique. It's not something that they want the Academy to teach. So they're trying to adopt rules to say, we're not going to teach that, which they didn't anyway. However, they do throw in a caveat that they say, unless the circumstance is one in which the peace officer may use deadly physical force. So if the officer is justified in using deadly physical force, then, and they use this carotid technique, then they're covered under the House bill. And again, it's an extreme measure. It's the last option, and it would be up there with shooting someone, basically.
Don, this is Megan.
Yes.
If we remove it from our policies, does it then just fall under like this House bill state law, or does it mean like you can't use it even in the deadly physical force?
So an officer would be covered through this House bill if they used it, and were justified in using it. And that's the key here, is that you would have to justify that you were using deadly force. If not, then there I would expect some disciplinary action as a result.
Okay, thank you.
Policy 300.4.1, shooting at or from moving vehicles. This one was kind of interesting. I don't want to confuse shooting at moving vehicles.
Donnie?
Yes.
I think Mark had a question on the last one. Is that sure. Right, Mark?
Yeah, thanks, Officer Chelly. Sort of along the lines of Megan's thing, by removing a technique from the manual, it doesn't say you shall not do it. Does that not complicate the review board stuff and things? Or is that there's so many things that we couldn't list all the things you're not supposed to do, so we're falling on training. Could you
comment on that? It would really just, that's really just a fallback. So it will not be in our policy. It's something that we don't use. If we do use it, if the officer uses it in a justified manner, they would be covered under the House bill. So whether we have it in our policy manual or not is kind of irrelevant, because it's covered under there, but only in extreme circumstances.
Sorry, I guess going on Mark's thing, do we have the ability as a city to just say it's not allowed even under this exemption, or does the state law preempt that?
I'm not sure if any city ordinance would supersede that House bill. I'm not really sure. And, you know, this is, again, I guess that would be something for the council to decide, but I'm not sure if there's any way to overrule the House bill.
Fair. Thanks, Don.
Any other questions on this? Yes.
Tim?
Yeah, I mean, do you all get trained on doing this, the chokehold?
No, I've never had training on it. I went through the police academy in 2003. Chief Holstey went through before me. I'm not sure if they were teaching it then, but it's nothing we've ever been trained on. So it's nothing that even here locally within the department, I had any use of force training. It's nothing that we've ever been trained on.
Yeah. You know, I don't know one way or the other. I have absolutely no clue, but it kind of seems like you're trained on a variety of different techniques. And I assume that there's probably a proper way to do it and an improper way to do it. And it seems like in the absence of some type of training, it's just a weird, it seems like an odd thing to have in your set of tools if it's banned and you're not being trained on doing it. And that's just an observation. It's not really a question.
Sure. And I totally understand that. And, you know, there are a lot of things there are a lot of techniques or weaponry that we're not trained in. However, for instance, if there is somebody on top of an officer trying to get his gun, and the only thing we can do is come up and pull that person off, would we be justified in using deadly force? And the answer to that is yes. If the person was truly trying to get the officer's gun to cause harm, then yes, in that case, you'd be justified. So, that's an extreme example. And I understand your question. If you're not trained in it, then why even deal with it? You know, we're not trained in throwing rocks. We're not trained in a lot of things, but if we were pressed in a situation that was going to save a life, we would just have to, you know, do whatever we could do to save that person's life.
It just seems odd to call it out this way, but again, that's just an observation.
Right. And I get the confusion of, well, it's banned, it's not taught, but you're covered if you use it. So that makes total sense.
Thank you.
Yep.
I think that when we discussed it as a subcommittee, we talked about this one a lot. And I think that it was, you know, it's like using a gun. I mean, it is, you don't use it for any other reason as you're in desperate straits, you know, a dire situation. And that would be the only reason you would use it, because you couldn't get your gun, or you couldn't, you know, you were in a bad situation with somebody on top of you or whatever. So that is why this, you know, deadly physical force, I think, is in this House bill, because if you had to grab somebody around the neck because it was the only way you could survive, then that's what you would do. You would be in that dire situation. It wouldn't be just to control someone. It would be like pulling out your gun. Yeah. We had quite a bit of discussion.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions on this one? Okay, so shooting at or from moving vehicles. This is not meant to be, when we're dealing with, say, a police pursuit, you know, we're chasing another car. This is talking about when can an officer shoot at a vehicle or shoot from a vehicle. And shooting at a vehicle has more to do with there are no other options. Say, for instance, you're in an alley. The car is coming at you. You have no means of escape, and they're targeting you with that vehicle. So they're using that vehicle as a weapon. Then you're justified in shooting to try to get the driver to stop. if you have any means of getting out of the way, then you need to get out of the way. You cannot move to put yourself in harm's way. Shooting from a moving vehicle, kind of like the carotid hold, it's not something we've ever been taught. It's nothing that the academy doesn't teach shooting from a moving vehicle. So we ultimately, we're going to split these up into two different policies, shooting at a moving vehicle and shooting from a moving vehicle. We decided just to remove the wording shooting from a moving vehicle, since it's just something we don't do and we're not trained in. The first sentence, shots fired at or from a moving vehicle are rarely effective. We felt like that was irrelevant. We ended up just taking that sentence out. The title we changed from shooting at or from moving vehicles, we changed to shooting at moving vehicles, preventing risk of harm. I thought that flowed a little better. And the area where it says an officer should only discharge a firearm at a moving vehicle or its occupants when the officer reasonably believes there are no other reasonable means available to avert the threat of the vehicle. CIS, again, thought that the word should was a little weak and that we should instead substitute shall in there. And we did so. Any questions about this one? So this is policy 300.5. This is actually something that we didn't talk about in the subcommittee. This is something, some information we got after our last meeting, and it has to do with use of force reporting. And the FBI launched the use of force data collection program. And what they said is if there's an officer, if an officer causes the death of a person by using force, if the officer causes serious bodily injury because of the force, or if they fire their weapon at somebody, even if they miss, they don't hit them, but they fired in their direction, then we have to, within 5 days, report that to the FBI. So this is a brand new policy that we are implementing. Policy 304.4, verbal and visual warnings, has to do with taser deployments. And when we have a situation where we're using our taser, it is, it's not to inflict pain. It is to gain compliance. And sometimes it's a better option than trying to go hands-on with somebody that you know wants to fight. And we do have times where the person tells us, I'm not going with you, and they take a stance, and it's just not going to be good. So rather than trying to fight with them, we can present the taser and warn them, if you don't do this, you're going to get tased. And our policy said that a warning should precede the taser application. And CAS said, well, again, we think it should be shall. We think you should give a warning. Or think you shall give a warning. And kind of like some of the other policies, it's not always practical to give a warning. In all seven of our deployments that I listed earlier, I would say we gave plenty of warning in those situations. But there may be a time where we can't. Things happen so fast. The situation may be very fluid and very rapid. We just don't have time to warn somebody about what we're going to do. But warning them provides them with a reasonable opportunity to voluntarily comply. And it provides the other officers around to know that, okay, we have a taser out. We're going to possibly deploy this taser if the person does not comply. And, it comes down to officer safety, and it comes down to the safety of the individual that we're dealing with. We don't want to inflict any pain. We don't want to inflict any harm. We want this to end peacefully. And a lot of times the taser is a very good deterrent. I can't tell you the times that we've taken the taser out and told the person, you're going to get tased, I don't want to tase you, and they will comply. And that's the result we want, is We don't have to go with hands-on with anybody. We don't have to, you know, wrestle with anybody and go to the ground to gain compliance. So the taser is really a great tool for compliance. And sticking with taser deployment, so policy 304.5.2, this one talked about individuals that we should generally avoid tasing. Who are people who are known to be pregnant, elderly people, obvious juveniles, individuals with low body mass, somebody who's handcuffed or restrained, somebody who's been pepper sprayed because there's a possibility that it can be flammable if you have the taser and OC spray, that's not a great combination. Or somebody who may be in result or somebody who's in a position or activity that it may result in collateral injury if they're up on a ledge. If they're you know, somewhere high and we tase them, they could fall and hurt themselves. And CAS, the recommendation was that, you know, let me change the screen here. So they said we should not be tasing anyone known to be pregnant. We shouldn't be tasing anyone in handcuffs, anyone who's been, you know, pepper sprayed or somebody who could fall and injure themselves. And so we made the change. We split this up into two sections in this policy. The individuals that we should generally avoid using the taser on are elderly and obvious juveniles or somebody with low body mass. And I can tell you, we've never used the taser on anybody who fits this criteria. But the second part of this policy is these are the people that we will not use the taser on, and we will not use it on people that are known to be pregnant, restrained, have been pepper sprayed, or could injure themselves further from being tased. Any questions about those policies? The other part of this subcommittee group was you know, reaching out to the community and seeing where we could have better communication and you know, join our community partners to have community events. And every year we probably are involved in 30 to 40 community events. And even outside of that, we have a number of officers who are involved in coaching from you know, the little league level all the way up through high school football. So there are probably 4, 5, 6 of our officers that are involved in that. But these are just a small sample of what we've been doing. The shop with the cop is one of our favorites. So that's, you take kids from our local schools, you know, elementary schools, from families who maybe don't have the means to provide the Christmas they want to give to their children. So the school will pick some children to send down, and they team up with a police officer and, you know, get somewhere between $100, $150, and we get to go shopping. And we get to walk around and help that child shop. And it's a great thing. And, you know, we watch them. Some are very selfless, and they will buy presents for their family members. And it's a great thing to see. We're involved in, you know, the Easter egg hunt at Jackson Park. We do a lot of ride along programs, and right now because of COVID, we're not able to do those programs, but we love for people to ride with us and see the calls we go on and, you know, just see what we do during a shift. We do a lot of safety talks, a lot of business security walkthroughs. If they are confronted with a violent patient or client or aggressive, what should they do? And, you know, we talk about active shooter situations where, you know, what's their best course of action if somebody comes into their facility with a weapon or, you know, a gun. So we also talked about, well, what else can we do? And during these discussions, especially nationally, we want to, you know, include everybody all races, all ethnicities. And, you know, we think we do a pretty good job of that with the programs that we're already involved in, but there's always, you know, more we can do. So we want to say, what is a good two-way communication for us to reach out to, you know, the Latino population? And so I met with a director of programs at the Next Door and spoke with him about, you know, what we're doing and a little bit about, you know, how can we get involved? And I also asked him about public perception. And I said, in his opinion, I said, do you feel that people are afraid of us? And, you know, more specifically, the Latino population, do you think they're afraid of the police? And he asked me, you know, for what? And I said, excessive force, police brutality. And he said, no, he said, that's not our community. That's not our town. That's not our police department. He said, what people do fear are immigration issues. There's a lot of, you know, misinformation out there about the immigration process. And when immigration comes to town, they may notify our dispatch center, but we aren't necessarily told that they're here. So I think there's a lot of misconception about locally our police department or our sheriff's office is involved in immigration operations. And that's just not the truth. We have nothing to do with what, you know, immigration comes to town for. So we would like to, talk to the community a little bit more about our role in that. And he told me about some programs that we could get involved in through the Next Door. And one is Latinos in Acción, and they leads the health equity work in Hood River. The priorities are leadership development, county ID card, housing, transportation, access to healthy foods and or free or low cost physical activities. He was saying maybe join some of the meetings. I think they have monthly meetings, and we can listen to a lot of the concerns and worries that our Latino population have. Another suggestion was Radio Tierra, and this is something that we have previously been involved in. Chief Holstey, Sheriff English have both been on the radio and even addressing you know, immigration issues and other issues that might come up. But we thought it might be good to just do some good, you know, Q&A segments, whatever, you know, maybe once a month, whatever a community wants to know, they can submit questions and we can go on the radio and talk about these things. So we have some really good opportunities that we can look forward to. And so why is that so important for us? It's all about building relationships and building trust in the community and community safety and understanding community problems to address these together. And our officers, I think we do a really good job of getting out and talking to people. We get out and we talk to business owners and we have a lot of good relationships within the community. And that's really big for our department and our culture and our philosophy. So we're going to continue to build on these programs and just try to find the most effective way to continue that community trust. And that's the end of my presentation. Are there any questions? Okay.
Yeah. Mark, go ahead, and then Tim, and then Gladys. Okay.
So thanks a bunch, Officer Chilley. I know, you know, this is might be an uncomfortable thing to do this kind of review, but it feels good that we're doing it to me, and I appreciate you guys taking it seriously and this review. It's great. My questions are, and I don't know if it's for you or for Rachel. Just with these updates, what's the approval process? Is it a administrative adoption, or is it council, or what?
Do you mean with our policy updates?
Yeah.
It's ultimately Chief Holstey. So we've made the changes. we put those changes out to our officers in the Officers Association. They can review them. They can, you know, give us some feedback on what they think. And then after a 14-day period, they're implemented.
Okay. And then my other question is, you know, you could just sort of see the history of this document building up the use of for, you know, the policies document, but it's 31 pages long, and that's just a really hard thing for any human to get their mind around. And I don't know if it's, you know, it's certainly not for today, but I'd be curious to see if there's policy manual models that are more efficient and digestible by humans. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. So just a little history on our policy. So we go through a company called Lexapol, and they're kind of the gold standard for policy writing nationally. And so they will write our policies. We can tailor them to our own specific needs and what fits our department. And I know what you're saying, you know, anytime we put policies out to our officers, you know, you can almost hear the groaning because there's so much information. But what it really comes down to is the policies are guidelines. We have to rely on common sense. Is this the right thing to do or not? If you're doing something that's foolish, if you're doing something that's reckless, most likely you're breaking our policy. So if your intentions are good and you're using good common sense, you're most likely going to be in that policy. But I understand what you mean. Can we streamline these a little bit? Can we shorten them? Yes and no. There's so much to go over. We actually have cut our policy manual down probably by half when Chief Polsky became chief. There's a policy for everything. I think there was a policy for pumping gas. You know, it was just it's a lot of paperwork, and it's a lot of you know, it's a lot of language in there. So, but again, we rely on our common sense and training just to do the right thing. And really, you know, when we have use of force reviews, we look at that. We look what the officer did, and it's we can tell pretty quickly if our officer did the right thing or not. Great. I would love to see every policy be one page or less. I don't know if that's possible or not with, you know, the legalities today.
And I think you're right that, you know, Chief and his senior staff training, using it as a training thing and flowing down that way, it makes perfect sense to me. So yeah. Again, I appreciate what you guys are doing. Keep up the good work.
So. And we do monthly policy training. So we'll take, one policy once a month. Our training coordinator will give that to us, and we'll have to read the policy and take a test on it. So we're constantly training throughout the year, and we're constantly doing use of force training and defensive tactics training to make sure that we're doing things the right way.
I think Tim had a question, and then Gladys, and then I see that Dan Kearns has his hand up too. So let's Tim, and then Gladys, and then Dan.
Thank you, Mayor. And thank you, Officer Chelly, for your presentation. It's very well done. I appreciate that. I think this kind of like follows on some of your comments about being kind of the reasonableness of this thing. And it was mentioned over and over in your presentation. That it has to be like a reasonable use of force. That's one of the criteria. And it, when I was reading the policy, I looked at and I noticed that there's a review board section. Mm-hmm. And so I guess I have a few questions about that. I guess my first question would be, has the review board ever been convened?
No, so if you read, the review board is for serious physical injury or even death. And we haven't experienced that here at the Hood River Police Department. So to my knowledge, and I think the chief would agree that the review board has never convened. Now, if we're talking about a use of force report. That report gets turned in and it will be reviewed by a sergeant or a lieutenant, myself. But as far as the review board policy, no, we've never experienced that. It's outlined what we're supposed to do. We've just never had it. We've never had the serious physical injury or death as a result of our force.
Yeah. I guess as a matter of semantics, I guess the first sentence in 301.4 says very serious injury. I think we probably strike the very part of that and just say serious injury and death. I don't know why we would need that qualifier. But I also noticed that there are specific recommendations for the composition of the board if we ever get to that point. And it struck me that there are no non-police members on that board or recommended to be on that board. Is that something that's typical, and what's the reasoning behind that?
You know, I don't know the exact reasoning behind it, but my best guess would be, as law enforcement officers, certified officers, we're trained. We have hundreds and hundreds of hours of training on these issues. Somebody from the outside who knows nothing about use of force, if they come on, it's going to be a lot of catching them up about what is proper use of force, what is excessive use of force. So my guess when I read that was just that there's experience on the review board, and we know how to read the policies, but I'm sure that's something that is an easy addition if we want to have a citizen on the review board. You know, we're very transparent. It'd be okay with me and probably Chief Holstein as well.
Yeah, I think that would be something that to be considered. I noticed there's actually a comment saying on there questioning whether there's any training for even the police folks that are on there to assume that role. So if there's going to be training for everybody, then training a member of the public or some other non-police person, and that probably wouldn't be terribly problematic.
Right. We had years ago, we had a citizen advisory board. It was a panel of citizens who they were involved in what we were doing. We would show them our policies, show them anything new we're doing. And, you know, they would look at some of these reviews. And, I don't know if we weren't exciting enough for them. I'm not sure. It kind of disbanded and people soon lost interest. So we haven't had the advisory board in probably 10 years or more.
Right. I guess that was going to be one of my other questions is, even for the reviews that you do now, are those reviews available to the public? Is that public information that they can access?
Yes. I mean, it's everything that we do here is generally available to the public, aside from active criminal cases that we're working on.
Thank you very much for those answers.
Gladys?
Yeah, thank you, Mayor. Thank you, Officer Shaley, for your presentation, and thank you all for your patience during our very long meetings to really discuss all of these questions. So I don't have any questions about what you just showed us, but I just have a comment. One of your slides showed going to Latinos en Acción and being a part of that, also Radio Tierra, but I didn't see anything in there on how the police department plans to engage, for example, our Native American population and even like our low income, white people that we have here in town. So I just wanted to make that comment on there that I just identify that's folks who are missing. And if you could just add them on there, please.
Thank you.
Thanks, Gladys. Dan, if Jonathan can.
Can you hear me?
We can hear you, Dan. Thank you.
I don't know if this is the appropriate place for me to jump in, but a couple of legal questions came up. I wanted to inject an answer and not interrupt your discussion. I think Tim had a question about whether the city can be more restrictive than House Bill 4203, which prohibits use of the chokehold, but still allows it in use of in situations where deadly force is used. That's what our policy manual already provides. It prohibits the use of the chokehold as a less than deadly force technique. But as the lieutenant said, when deadly force is justified, police officers will use whatever means are available, including the chokehold, presumably. But we can be more restrictive than state law allows. And the question would come up is if there, say, a police officer used that a chokehold in a situation that called for less than deadly use of force, that would be a disciplinary action. It could also give rise to liability to the city for that sort of thing. So in these instances, you also need to ask, what's the consequence if they do it? So so we can be more restrictive, but we do prohibit it as a less than deadly technique. It hasn't been trained on for over 15 years, and so our manual is pretty clear about that. The question came up about use of the Lexapol policies. Every one of my jurisdictions that I've ever worked in that has a police force uses the Lexapol police manual as the model, and they kind of pick and choose, but you know, the whole manual itself is huge, and it's used throughout the nation, throughout the world, and I would say from a tort liability perspective, you don't want to make up your own policies. I don't think your insurance carrier would cover your own policies that you make up. And a lot of detail is usually important in these situations because they are life and death matters. So that's the reason that Lexapol policies have evolved to the level of detail that they have. It's driven, I would say, entirely by litigation. And these use of force lawsuits are not super common, but they are extremely expensive for local jurisdictions to defend. And so insurance and lawyers drive these policies. The other question about can we amend these? The lieutenant said that there isn't a very complicated process for amending these, but understand if you amend your policies to the point where they change working conditions, that would trigger a negotiation with the bargaining unit. We can't change hours, wages, or working conditions without negotiating under the contract. So that would take somewhat of a significant change in policies, but I wouldn't say that every sort of change to the policy manual can just be done unilaterally. So that's what I have so far in terms of legal questions that have come up, unless people have others.
I just wanted to, you're next, Jessica. I just wanted to ask Dan, so from what he sees that the subcommittee went through and what Donnie just explained, that's something that probably wouldn't trigger anything that we would need to negotiate with the bargaining unit?
It doesn't sound
I think, yeah, and actually that is why Lieutenant Shaley mentioned that he had sent these out for review. I kind of rely on the chief and lieutenant to manage that piece of it, but I would say no.
Okay, Jessica.
Thank you, Mayor, and thank you, Lieutenant. I had a question for the lieutenant, and then maybe a question for the committee. But the so you had mentioned that there was, you know, the small blip in the use of force cases, and it's tied because there's more arrests happening, and I just wondered why maybe there are more arrests happening, or there were in 2018 and 2019.
So the only way I can really answer that is to say it seems that every year we're taking on a little bit bigger call load, and our officers have been very proactive as far as enforcing DUIs. We have, for the state of Oregon, for being a smaller agency, we have one of the highest liquor license per capita in the state. And we arrest a lot of intoxicated drivers. We, it's kind of a, for lack of a better word, kind of, random. We can't predict when somebody's going to go out and commit a crime. We just have to react to that. So the number of arrests, why are they going up? I don't know. There's just been, there's been more crime. So that's kind of a complicated question to answer. And I'm sorry, I don't have a better answer for you.
No, that's okay.
Yeah.
And this just maybe is a question for the committee. I don't know if it's a question for the lieutenant, but I was just wondering about next steps. Because I look, we talked about the next steps on the policies, but then if I look at the council pledge, talked about, engaging the community, reporting the findings, reforming the use of policies. So I guess, is this that last step, or did the committee see other steps happening?
Yeah, I mean, I think for this evening, that we would, if we agree that these are the changes we want, that the subcommittee recommended, that would be what tonight, that's what it is. Then we talked a little bit more about the possibility of some other training that the police department might do specifically with Nextdoor, and going back to a little bit more additional outreach with Radio Terra. And then from there, it's kind of going to be kind of up to the council how much more training, we want. We talked about diversity, equity, inclusion training, which isn't this, but we talked about that for staff, and we talked about that for council. So, those are kind of all possible next steps, but I think, we need more discussion on those things, but I think tonight we are about 40 minutes past our time frame for this right now. So we definitely need to talk about it, but I don't know that we're going to get into a big, long discussion this evening. Megan, go ahead. And then Rachel, you might be able to expand a little bit on next steps too, but go ahead, Megan.
I want to come back to what you said, but I did just one small thing on the 300.2.1 duty to intercede, where it's an officer using force that is clearly beyond, and I'm wondering if it could just be beyond, or why that needs to be like such a high standard.
It can, are you talking about the House bill, or are you talking about our department policy?
Our existing department policy. Any officer present and observing another officer using force that is clearly beyond that which is objectively reasonable. Would it not just be beyond?
I wouldn't have an objection with clearly being taken out of there.
Okay. Well, I guess so. Maybe that's the group. and then kind of going back to Jessica's question and Kate's answer of, my understanding when we started this was that we were going to work with the Nextdoor or some other trusted outside entity to really engage the community and get feedback on what other folks think of our use of force or our policies or what they would want to change. And I'm wondering how that's going to be done. Because what you just said, Kate, didn't seem like we were going to do that anymore.
No, not necessarily. That would be one of the things that the police department would be doing with the Nextdoor, as I understood it. So Rachel, maybe you could answer that question.
Sure. So what we talked about in terms of next steps is making sure that this information is communicated broadly to the community. So, the police department working with communication staff to get this information out and to accept some feedback. including talking, expanding that beyond our normal channels to Radio Terra, Latinos in Acción, and really trying to support that two-way dialogue. That's kind of where we stopped in terms of this project, in terms of use of force policies and getting engagement and feedback. If council is interested in doing broader outreach, we have some ideas, we can brainstorm some ideas. And again, I think it's really important piece of this. I think we need to understand a little bit more what it is that council's talked about a number of things. So we're still looking for some additional direction about whether council wants to do that as a group, as a council group, if council wants to participate in a listening session with the community. And again, happy to brainstorm some ideas for council to consider, but be helpful at this point to get some additional input from council on that.
So with the outreach that is planned for the police department and getting this out, do we see that, depending on the feedback we get from the community, we would go back and look at these policies and potentially make some other changes?
Yeah, that's a great question, Counselor. Thank you. I think that is at the root of all of this. That's at the root of what the lieutenant explained and the purpose of community outreach is understanding community problems, building relationships, building trust. So absolutely, if in all of that outreach, if in all of the community relationships that the department is building, if they are hearing of issues, then it's incumbent upon them to address them. I think Lieutenant Shaley gave a good example of that with regards to issues of immigration. If there are questions out there and issues that need to be addressed, that's what the police department will do together with the community.
And I think we could go narrow, we could go broad, we could go, you know, but I think that this is kind of first steps, and you know, first steps as quickly as we can step, and then, you know, assess how that's going, get feedback, and then we're going to probably do another step. We don't know what that step might be yet, whether it's going to be more narrow or more broad, but I think it's better than just shotgunning something, and let's just start there with the communication that they're planning on doing, and then feedback from that, and then we'll, you know, see where we need to go from there, versus, you know, just going really broad right away and not really knowing if that's really the direction we should go. Tim?
I have kind of a broad question, I guess. Is, you know, I think Lieutenant Shaley mentioned multiple times about the effects of mental illness and intoxication, which I guess could be termed as a form of mental illness with short term. And I'm kind of wondering, I don't know where this falls into this whole thing. Is there any thought about either figuring out a way to bolster our capabilities to deal with those folks, or whether it's through additional training for the officers and the police department, or by enlisting the services of some other organization? That's kind of a really broad question, but it seems important.
Yeah, when we get to the League of Oregon Cities, what do we want them to lobby for? There's one, exactly what you're talking about, Tim, mm-hmm. is one of those things, additional funding and, you know, some more help for that.
I have a Others? Comment.
Gladys?
I think Tim brought up a very important fact. You know, we're in the discussion of discussing building a bigger police department and what that could mean. I think it's important that we hear what, you know, Lieutenant Shaley's telling us, that mental health services are a barrier in our community, and figuring out how can we higher contract, more than we already are with these community partners, these mental health agencies are figuring out ways that we can provide our own behavioral health specialists that work at the police department, and it's all within the entity of the police as opposed to having a contract with other providers to be able to offer those services. I also think it's important for us to know that us doing this work, you know, this one time, that we'll have to follow up and do this yearly based on what our constituents tell us. That's really going to be part of the driver of how much more we do moving forward, is based on the feedback that comes from them.
Other comments, and then we're going to try to wrap up this discussion.
So I guess I'd just ask the rest of council if the clearly beyond could just be changed to beyond, or what the process would be for that.
Say that again, Megan. That what?
In the duty to intercede policy, the use of using force that is clearly beyond that which is objectively reasonable to just beyond, is that something other folks are interested in changing, or is that just me?
I'm for it.
I'm for it. Looks like we have a majority of people that would be okay with changing that. All right. Do you want a motion, Rachel? Would you like a motion? You don't need that. If we have a consensus for this, I'd just like to see a nod of heads that people are good with what the subcommittee came up with. Megan's got a change. And if you're good with that, let's just, I'd actually, because some people are listening on the phone, I actually think it's best if you agree with the subcommittee recommendations and the one change that Megan made. I'd just like people to say yes, and I'm going to call their name, because people that are listening on the phone don't know what's happening here sometimes. Megan?
Yes.
Jessica?
Yes, and thank you again to our police department for doing this.
Eric?
Yes, I would probably run that latest change by the insurance representative to make sure that there's not some liability issue that might unnecessarily create for us, but as a policy matter, I'd be fine with it.
Okay, Tim?
Yes, with I guess kind of the caveat that I think we should still look at the review board portion of this and delve into it in more detail. So that's kind of my I think it's bigger than we can deal with tonight, but I think it's worth looking at.
Okay. Thanks for that input. Gladys?
Yes, with the correction that Megan made and the suggestion from Councillor Cunahan.
Mark?
Yeah, I'm happy with how you guys reviewed the policy stuff, and I'm happy with the changes. I do think this is just a step in the community discussion, but for what we set out to do here, we're doing great. So thank you.
Okay, and I also agree with the changes that Megan made and the suggestion from Eric about checking with the insurance, and that as one more step, Tim's suggestion, I think that's a good suggestion too. Okay, thank you very much. Appreciate the time, Donnie and Neil and Rachel on all this. And Eric and Gladys, we had several long meetings and good discussions, thank you. Okay, let's, COVID-19, Rachel.
Sure, thank you, Mayor, Councilors. This information is all in your packet. The purpose of this is really just to communicate the intention to council, my intention to council, to continue the local state of emergency due to COVID-19 until the end of September. This enables us to maintain readiness, resiliency, and specifically, it means that all utilities are continued regardless of a customer's ability to pay. That some of our highly visited parks remain closed, such as waterfront playground and the children's park playground. Civic buildings are open to the public with limited services. And we continue to collaborate in the Emergency Operations Center with other local entities. And another specific example, food trucks are permitted to remain in place longer than 180 days to support local businesses and because of public health permitting. And then we have suspended non-essential in-person meetings. So that's a kind of a status report. I know we committed to, you know, checking in with council every once in a while and thought this was a good opportunity to do that. And if we extend it, you know, to into September, we'll present another opportunity to touch base with council, answer any questions, and go from there. So that's all I have.
Great. Questions for Rachel on this? Megan?
Just one minor thing with the transient merchants, you know, so the utilities, we did the like 60 day kind of tail off, and is the transient merchants, would it be like the day the emergency ends they need to move, or is there some sort of like pathway to that process?
Thank you. That's a very thoughtful question, Counselor. I'd be open. I hadn't really thought about that. I'd have to give some thought, but I can't imagine that we would go out and just simply ask people to move. They're all aware of what's going on. But if council wanted to consider, you know, a similar language, a 60-day extension, something like that to the utilities, I'm open to your feedback on that.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I guess on my end, I certainly felt like it wasn't staff's intention to say, you know, you must immediately leave. But if something in writing would be useful for them to have some clarity, I think that is valuable for, you know, some level of business security in an incredibly insecure time.
Yeah, I think that's a great, good consideration, Megan. Others?
I'm seeing head nods, so I'll go ahead and make that.
Okay, great. That's all on that one. League of Oregon Cities legislative priorities.
I
sent an email out on this a little late. Sorry, you guys. Just reminding everyone to look at that list so we could kind of try and consolidate it tonight. So hopefully you had time to pick your winners. Whether they'll get picked at the state level, who knows? But Rachel, did you want to talk about this a little bit?
Sure. Mayor and councilors, again, I apologize. It is a lot of information, and all of these are pretty complex policy items. But the purpose of this is to get consensus from the council, and then staff will simply fill out a ballot sheet with our preferences so that the League of Oregon Cities can build their legislative priorities and their legislative approach. I have served on an LOC committee before, so it's interesting to see some of these that have been talked about for many, many years. Finally making it to the list. So I don't have much to add. I think the mayor and council president are prepared to facilitate the conversation.
So, you know, we could talk about these all night, but we just need to pick these. So I was thinking what we would do is, and I'm not sure if we can get someone to help us keep track of where we are with these.
I can do that, Mayor.
Okay, that would be great. And maybe we can say what your very first priority is. I think maybe just go around and do that and give it its letter if you have that. And then your second, your next pick, we can see if we can get any overlapping priorities here, hopefully. So let's just go around everyone and message to your very first pick that you think that is the very most important of the, I believe there was 26 items that we could pick from. It was a huge list. So let's see. Megan?
We're just doing the first one right now.
Yeah, let's just do the first one. We'll see what our everyone's highest priority is.
Okay, so mine was the letter D, COVID-19 economic recovery investment.
Okay. Jessica?
I potentially misunderstood the instructions, and then I just kind of picked my top four because I thought it was four.
Okay, that's okay. That's okay.
And I didn't rank them, so I'm already being not helpful.
All right. Well, just pick one to give us.
In alphabetical order, then, I guess, H, housing and services investment.
Okay. Eric?
I was very close between Y and Q as my first, but I'll say Y, tort liability reform.
All right, Gladys?
I chose Q.
Q, all right, which is mental health. Tim?
I picked D.
Which is?
Economic recovery investments.
Okay, Mark?
So did you say D is in?
Dog.
D is in dog.
I had D and Q as first. One is, you know, unemployment continuation. I think that's foundational. And then Q is mental health stuff. Either of those two is my number one. I got it down to 8. I was being pretty proud.
All right. And I had U, which is property tax reform. Let's go to our second choices, Megan. Or whatever choice, another one.
I followed the rules. I have H, housing and services investment.
Okay, we're starting to get some overlap, and I can hear some numbers I've got on my list, so that's good. Jessica?
Q, mental health services delivery.
Eric?
Q, mental health.
Gladys?
I heard H, so I'll go with N.
N, as in no.
N as in no, yeah.
Okay. Tim?
H, housing and services investment.
Mark?
So I heard D and Q, so there was L and G were both local power investment stuff. Which one of those, and this is maybe a question for Rachel, of L and G, which one helps facilitate our micro hydro thing?
Mark, are you not taking your second of your two from last time?
No, I'm not following the rules like you are.
Kelter, I will have to get more information about which one would okay. be better. That's a concept that the council wants to support. I'll figure that out.
All right. So I'm L or G, whichever one helps our effort the most. So.
Okay. And my second choice is Q. Megan, third.
Q, mental health services.
Jessica.
Well, so I had O and U. So O is low income energy efficiency and affordability programs, and U is the property tax reform.
Okay, Eric?
Third choice I had I, which was increased local budget flexibility.
Gladys?
I've heard all of them except for O. I also had O.
Tim?
I was going to pick C, building a reach code.
Mark?
And O is an add-on.
I like that all the assistance for bills adds up to hoes. So H-O-Z-E. So I would any and all of those. So.
What is your number? What is your letter?
Let's see. I will say O.
O. All right. Oh, and I'm going to pick F, expedited siting for shelter and affordable housing. All right, so that's three. If people picked four, let's do one more round. And if you have four, we'll see what that last choice might be. Megan?
I had O, the low income energy efficiency and affordability programs.
Jessica?
I already gave all my four. Rachel,
The last two, you gave two, didn't you? Okay, Eric?
J is in Jack for infrastructure financing.
Gladys?
I already gave my four as well.
Okay, Tim?
I think I mentioned O.
And Mark?
I also had J.
J.
I think Mark gave like five.
I think he got seven.
And I'll say Z, which is water utility rate and fund assistance. And I had some of these other ones you guys had, but, you know, they were my number six, number seven, number eight. So H and G and C, but they were lower down. Do we have any, what kind of commonalities do we have, Rachel?
I am doing some quick math here.
Okay.
We have a number of H's and a number of O's. And let me just, and some D's. I think so far we have H, O, and D. But what I will do is tally this up for your fourth, if that's what you would like to do. So for H, we have housing and services investment. O, which actually got more votes, is low income efficiency and affordability. D is COVID economic recovery investments. And then I'll have to add these up for your four.
Okay. Just looking. You think you have enough for what you need, Rachel?
I think we do. Thank you.
Okay. Great. Thank you, everyone, for that exercise.
I'll let you know what the final tally is.
Okay. Eric, did you have a question?
Oh, I just had a question about, I wasn't sure if the counting was weighted, because I did notice early on there was a lot of people that seemed to support the mental health one, and we moved on. So that's, I don't know if the weighting is part of it or not.
Well, I was hoping that all the number ones, you know, we would have maybe several people, but it was kind of all over the board with our number ones. So I think we kind of have to go to the number twos and threes, because we had so many things that went all over the place. I heard quite a few Qs also, but that actually, is that going to come up there, Rachel, high or what?
Actually, that's the number one.
Q is the number one.
In terms of just number of votes, Q appears to have gotten the most, but I think the point is well made on the weighting. So whoever counts wants to handle.
Okay. Well, we talked about it in the first subject of the evening too, mental health. So, you know, it's come up quite a bit lately. So it seems fairly important to people.
So the order then would be mental health, service delivery, O, low income, energy efficiency, housing, H is housing, and then COVID response.
Thanks. Thank you everyone for doing that exercise. We'll put our votes in and see what the league does with it. So I'm gonna adjourn the work session. It is 7:33 and open the regular council meeting. Do we have any agenda additions or corrections?
We do not, Mayor.
Okay. We have a consent agenda, which has two items on it, our council meeting minutes and Columbia Land Trust Mountain Vistas Phase 3 Track 2 easement, which we got a very lengthy information and maps. And I don't know if anyone, it was just on consent agenda, but does anyone have a question, I guess, for staff on that? It was pretty well explained in the packet. Okay, I don't see any questions on that. Do I have a motion on the consent agenda?
I would move we approve the consent agenda.
Looks like it.
Okay, Megan has made a motion to approve the consent agenda and Tim has seconded. Discussion? Roll call vote, Megan?
Yes.
Eric?
Aye.
Gladys?
Yes.
Jessica?
Aye.
Tim?
Aye.
Mark?
Yes.
Chair votes aye. Consent agenda is passed. Regular business items. Hood River garbage rate review. Jim Winterbottom. Jonathan, if you could put him in the queue to present.
Oh, there I am. Good evening, Mayor and members of council. Thanks for the opportunity tonight to be on the agenda. As Hood River Garbage annually does, we present a rate review case for proposed trash and recycling services and the cost involved with that. The last few years we've been in earlier in the year, which is in May or June, for a possible July implementation. Earlier in the year, I emailed City Manager Rachel Fuller and thought it best not to show up at that time based on COVID-19 and the circumstances, and asked that I come in a little bit later for a possible implementation of a September 1st rate increase. The proposal you have in front of you is based on a CPI of 2.53%. We ask for 85% of that, which would be an increase of 2.15%. That is what the Wasco County landfill was approved for January 1st of 2020. Some of the other things that are impacted by our increased ask are healthcare costs, environmental compliance, equipment, containers, and fleet maintenance. The one thing that I did not get notice on prior to sending this out, which is just part of conducting business, is that Dirt Hugger is increasing my tip fee for organics and yard waste 3% effective August 1st. So with that, a residential customer in town that has a 65-gallon trash cart serviced every other week with alternating recycling service and weekly organics, their current monthly bill is $26.13. The 2.15% increase would go to $26.70 per month, or 57 cents per month increase, which equates to 14 cents per week. A commercial customer that has a dumpster, yard and a half dumpster, they are currently paying $130.01 per month. They would see an increase of $2.85 a month, or 66 cents per pickup, which would bring their new cost to $132.86. If council had any questions, I would be glad to answer them if I can.
Okay, great. I have a question on your chart here, and I think it's page 98 of one of our packets, but at the top it says, and hope maybe you have it in front of you, it says residential 35 gallon cart, and then it says total LF increase, and then it says business increase. So what does that mean?
So what they do is, the way our controllers break it down is, the landfill increase itself for the tipping fee is what they're referring to as LF increase for landfill.
Oh, okay.
And then everything else is wages, equipment, maintenance, insurance, which they dump into a bucket they call business.
Okay. Okay, great. Thank you for the explanation of that.
Uh-huh.
Others, questions? Gladys?
Hi, yeah, Jim, I have a question. Thank you for coming on today. So while the increase might not be a whole lot for some of us. For some, it may. So what sort of services do you offer, for example, low-income families who are unable to support the cost increase?
Historically, we haven't done anything on a case-by-case basis. We just work with people on a regular basis to keep them serviced as long as they're making a good faith effort. We understand that, you know, times can be tough, and like you stated, any increase is difficult. So we don't have a set waiver for people that can't meet the requirements.
So if someone was unemployed during this time, you know, or someone, their unemployment is about to end, what would happen in that situation?
So since our billing went out in February, which for most residents was a February-March bill, most everything that we went with was a March implementation as far as COVID and the impact it was having financially on our ratepayers. We have not cut anybody off. We have not sent anybody to collections, but we have been asking them to work with us and keep us updated as to their ability or when they may have that ability to pay for services. It was never our intent to use this as a collection tool.
Okay, thank you.
I know that you have a senior citizen waiver of some sort, and I don't know if most people know that, but I know there is, over a certain age, you have some kind of a senior citizen waiver.
Correct. We work with MCAP, and anybody, I forget the threshold for the age breakout. I just was looking at it earlier today, as a matter of fact. We do basically pay for their services, and then we pay for MCAP to facilitate the contract of that service for an annual basis.
I thought my mom has this, and I think it's over 80 years old or something like that.
Could be. Yeah.
Additional questions, Mark?
Hey, Jim, thanks for coming in. When was the last time that you had a similar request? Was it before July of 19?
So July of 19 would have been the rate increase. We had a recycle surcharge earlier in 18, I guess, was a surcharge that moved the commingled recycle back to processors in Portland. So
I was just confused then, you know, are we on a schedule for annual review of these things?
So this one's been 15 months ago, basically. And I'm not looking to go retro back to July. If it is approved, it would be a September 1. Where we got off schedule was in 2017, when the CART program was rolled out to city residents. The CART program had an increase in, I think it was like May of 17. Then we did not come back in until July of 18 for a rate proposal.
Right. And then we had that whole gymnastics with mixed material market. So
yeah.
Okay, thanks.
Eric.
Hi, Jim. This is Eric Haney speaking. Thanks again for joining us. I had two questions. The first one was just answered, which was, is this a special increase or a standard step increase? And it sounds like it's just a standard annual step increase coming to us in July. And I don't have any problem with 2%. That sounds like it would be less than standard inflationary rate. But since you're here, I thought I would just ask you, since we did have a lot of effort that went into the recycling kind of reinvigoration 6 or 9 months ago, my question, Jim, can you speak to whether the COVID pandemic has created a situation like we had, I say we as a society, we had some time ago where recycling was just going into the landfill because we couldn't find a market for it? Is recycling, is that market functional in the COVID era?
It has been. Unfortunately, the charge per ton has increased drastically because of the amount of material. We are sending more material now than we did when we first rolled out the recycle carts, and it's all going to processors. The amount of scrap metal that people are bringing us is everything's record setting, as well as the glass. A lot of material, people have had a lot of time on their hands that have been at home, and they're hoping that they can recycle a number of items, which unfortunately are not acceptable materials. So we work with them on that and let them dispose of it for free, since they've already hauled it down here thinking they were going to recycle, you know, a glass chandelier as glass, which is not the case. So it's been a little bit of a challenge just based on sheer volume. I don't know if any of you had visited the transfer station since March, but it is a standing room only, and trying to facilitate social distancing and masks is a full-time job for our guys out front.
Thank you very much, Jim. Good to hear that it's working.
Yeah. Additional questions? All right. Do we need a motion? I didn't see.
Yes, Mayor.
I don't know that we
a motion that. To approve the rate increase.
Oh, just okay.
As presented.
Just to say, okay.
I will move that we approve the rate increase as presented.
I'll second.
I have a motion from Megan and a second from Mark to approve the rate increase by Waste Connections, Hood River Garbage Service. Additional discussion? I don't see any hands. Roll call vote. Eric?
Aye.
Jessica?
Aye.
Tim?
Aye.
Gladys?
Aye.
Mark?
Yes.
Megan?
Yes.
Chair votes aye. All right. Thank you, Jim. Appreciate you taking the time.
Thanks very much. Appreciate it.
Okay. We have an approval. Next, we have an intergovernmental agreement with ODOT regarding jurisdictional transfer. So Wade is going to take that.
Having trouble with my buttons here, sorry. And I can't seem to get the video working, but that's all right. Can you hear me all right?
We can hear you, yeah. We just can't see you.
So this is a jurisdictional transfer for Oak Street from ODOT to the city. Basically, the city would take over maintenance and operations of the stretch from State Street to 13th. It has been, it's come together rather quickly. So the agreement that's included is still in draft form. I think we're pretty close, but it's still in draft form at this time. I think we've provided a pretty comprehensive summary. I thought I would just go through a few bullet point pluses and minuses. So on the plus side, by entering into this agreement, we would take over control of our right of way for the most part. ODOT has agreed to update all the ADA ramps. I think there's something like 42 of them. They would eventually upgrade them regardless, but they've offered to do it even if we take over ownership. They will pave from 5th Street to 13th Street to bring it up to standards. And they've agreed to continue helping with snow removal. We currently kind of work jointly both on Oak Street and up on the Heights after the big events. They plow and they bring in their big trucks to help haul stuff off and extra loaders. They've agreed to continue that. On the minus side, it's not really total control. They'll still have some say in the signal operations. There'll still be some freight mobility requirements that we have to maintain, which just means we can't permanently restrict travel. It would be a lot easier for us to do temporary changes to the right-of-way, temporary closures. We would have to pay half the cost of the signal maintenance, which comes more into play when we get the new signal. And probably the biggest thing is long-term maintenance of the pavement. Every 20 to 30 years, it's going to need a grind and inlay or a rebuild. Currently, that ODOT would be responsible for that. The city would become responsible for it. We'll have new pavement for half of it, and the pavement on the other half through downtown is 15-ish years old. It's in good shape. The city already takes care of most of the pavement marking. ODOT does the centerline stripe. The city does all of the parking stalls. The sidewalk is already under control of the city. Tree wells, street lights, the city is already responsible for that, so there's no increase there. I think that's most of the highlights. If there's any questions on any of these particulars?
Okay, that's going to go. Oh, there you are, Wade. Mark, I think you had a question.
I have a couple of things. One, it's going so fast. Is this just this huge hot potato that they were just happy to get rid of? Is that a warning to us, I guess, that's from a staff perspective?
I think they're willing to work quickly because of some of our business concerns down there with the parklets.
So I met with Ryan Winsheimer and Rachel and Will, and you know, it's kind of like they wanted the parklets to move ASAP, like that day, tomorrow, whatever the day was that we met. And you know, if we weren't going to really move to this jurisdictional transfer ASAP, then they're like, you know, we need to move those things. And if we were willing to kind of, okay, let's just get with it, let's do it, we've got a template for doing this that we can plug all the information into, you know, and then get the legal descriptions and stuff like that, which would take time. Then they were like, well, the parklets can stay. But it was, you know, the parklets, it's like if they had to move out, they lose the 6 weeks that they need to do anything. And if we were going to do it, we were going to do it. Everyone was nodding their head. We want it. We want to have this section of road so we have control of it. We're sick and tired of it. So that was why they agreed to do it. And we're trying to get it done quickly because they really want it. You know, it's the parklets are their liability in their eyes until we get it. So they wanted it to happen quickly.
Okay.
And that's a good thing. This is actually an intermediate step leading to the actual transfer. It's an agreement to enter into it, and the Oregon Transportation Commission has to approve it. So, you know, it'll take some time, but this basically lets us act as if we had already taken over.
Okay. Does it impact the bump outs at Second Street, and does it give us the ability to do bump outs at the crossing at Fifth Street, for example, for pedestrian safety?
I think it would give us the ability to add bump outs at Fifth Street. I'm not sure how much effect it has on the bump outs at Second. They will still have control of that signal due to the proximity of I-84. It could be that their biggest interest is southbound traffic clearing out of the interchange, and they don't have as much concern about the bump outs. There will not be a bump out on the one corner, the right turn. So maybe,
But didn't we get that? Isn't that design approved as of 6 months ago?
It's still in the design exception process.
We need to give them more money to look at it again, right?
Right.
And then my last question is, I don't see either term or termination paragraphs in here, which it would be typical. And maybe I'm not seeing it, but I don't see that this is for X years or here's how either party gets out of it.
I did see mention of that, but not a time frame. I do remember there being mention of a way out, but I think it's more or less if we don't do what we're supposed to do to keep freight moving, they can take it over again.
General provisions 1 and 2, I see it now. So it's sort of if mutual consent and then or a state or federal laws.
Okay. Right.
Thank you.
Gladys, and then Megan.
Thank you, Mayor. I have a question, Wade. What is the yearly cost associated to us taking ownership of the roads, including all maintenance and the repair? I do see a cost of like $1,250, but what is the total, just like a guesstimate of the associated cost with having this road?
Most of the long-term cost is asphalt. I don't have a number, but the number that I got verbally that they thought it would cost to pave roughly half of it is $200,000. I think that might be a little low, so I would say, looking at paving the entire thing, it's probably four or five.
So wait. So ODOT is going to pave 5th through 13th. So yeah. After that point, then it will all be the city's responsibility. Mm-hmm. Is my understanding that the city actually paved the section between front and
right.
5th. So, and this is one of the things we ran into when we started looking at 12th and 13th. Ownership of the roadway does not necessarily mean that we'll get the maintenance.
Right.
That somebody right, because, else will get the maintenance. I think we're seeing that on Cascade as well.
Mm-hmm. So. Because of several urban renewal projects, we ended up doing the paving down there.
So maybe a question for Will. Will, knowing that this will be a potential cost at some point, is that something that the city is preparing for?
Well, we haven't prepared for it because obviously we didn't own it, and this is coming because of the parklet situation that we won't need to repave it for another 20, 25 years. So we'll put it into the normal the normal cycle. So it will be a draw on our gas tax. You know, as much as any other street is.
Okay, thank you. And then will this allow for future parklets?
Yeah, it would be our discretion.
Okay. And of the three that were identified as being issues or being the parklets that had to be removed, all three are allowed at this point to continue keeping the parklets, correct?
There were only two on Oak Street. The third was Folkswell on 12, and it has been relocated.
It has to, I didn't hear that. It has to what?
It has been relocated behind the building.
Oh, okay.
There's only two on Oak.
Okay. Those are all my questions. Thank you.
Additional questions? Megan? And then Megan? Eric, I think you raised your hand, and then Jessica.
Yeah. Thank you to staff for dealing with this way quicker than I think I ever thought the state would move. But And I, you know, I'm excited that this would solve the parklet issue, but I think kind of like the last two folks' questions, I don't want to take on long-term stuff to solve a short-term problem without it being in the city's best interest. So I guess in that realm, I saw on, you know, some of the maps of all the signals or the ADA ramps that are failing, there was also the signal at 9th and Oak was also poor. Are we going to be on the hook for having to replace or fix that?
It's the ramps at the signal that are rated poor. I don't think it's the signal itself.
So there's also the little box for the signal. So this is,
yeah, I saw that little box. There's
you can see this, right?
I think it would be a shared maintenance just like the other signal, but much less expensive.
Okay. Yeah, that's definitely one concern. And then I guess there was a lot of talk about what ODOT can still control, which I don't particularly love, but what, beyond parklets, what would we actually have control over with this IGA that we don't currently have?
It would be more temporary closures, First Friday events, that sort of thing wouldn't have to go through the state. Access for future driveways.
Okay. Thank you, Ed. And I guess one other thing, but we had originally talked about kind of, you know, first to fifth, first to sixth. And so it's like ODOT was only talking about this in the chunk where
that yeah, that's what they didn't like a dead end, more or less, for maintenance.
Okay. There. Thank you.
Eric?
Thank you, Mayor. And thank you, Wade and Rachel and everyone who worked on this. It seems like a classic case to me of turning lemons into lemonade. And, you know, my personal sense is having local control over this area that's the heart of our business community and our downtown is the right way to go. So I'm fully supportive of that. The only question I had relates back to a discussion that was before council maybe a year or so ago. And my takeaway from that discussion is that ODOT is concerned about traffic counts on the second street overpass. In other words, traffic heading down to the waterfront, such that if that hits a certain volume, we'll start losing parking so that we can have more queuing to turn, what is that, south on 2nd Street. So in other words, I was hearing a connection between too much traffic at the port and maybe having lose the loss of precious parking spaces in downtown on Oak Street. My question is, does this help alleviate that, or are we still gonna have ODOT looking over our shoulder on that 2nd Street overpass traffic counts?
We are. I think it potentially could help with the downtown parking. Can't say that with 100% certainty, but it seems logical to me that the influence on the freeway is the southbound traffic backing up. I could see them wanting an extended turn lane heading south on 2nd, but maybe being less interested in the movements from Oak.
Yeah, just to reiterate, in my conversations with ODOT, they are always going to care about what happens that close to the freeway, because as they, you know, admit, the freeway is their primary concern. That is kind of why we're in this position to take it over. But so we will always have conversations with them about something that's that close to the freeway. We're certainly, you know, in a slightly different position if we in fact do own the roadway.
Right. It would seem to, it would help not hurt us to the extent we were wanting to protect the parking spaces. Thank you.
Jessica, did you have a question?
Yeah, thank you. I remember from an email about this is that we had also maybe started a conversation about 12th and 13th. which I think actually, like, I'm in support of this, and I agree with Megan about, I wouldn't do it if there's larger benefits than just a short-term fix. But I think this 12th and 13th, if you guys remember last year, we were all grumpy. They took all of our crosswalks out. And with all the work that we want to do for the urban renewal up there, I think it's an even bigger benefit potentially to the community for us to take over those ones. So I guess an update from Rachel on that one.
Yeah, I'm happy to address that. And we did start talking about 12th and 13th. And as we got into these agreements, recognized that there are much bigger issues, I think, both for ODOT and for the city to consider with regards to those. From a staff perspective and looking at our urban renewal projects, absolutely there could be a benefit that the city would want to consider in terms of flexibility up there. So, I think both entities and in fact, if council was inclined to have us continue those conversations, we'd appreciate some direction on that. But from ODOT's perspective, cities, we're definitely interested in continuing that conversation. We just couldn't get it together, couldn't bring it all together as quickly as we needed to. So if that's something council's
yeah. Yeah, thanks for bringing that up, Jessica, because one, I got a new phone and I'm unable to, figure out how to get my email on. So I'm behind on email. If you've been trying to reach me, I haven't. And I was just wondering that as we're having this conversation, why, Slopeswell was asked to move their parklet if my understanding was they were having the same issue as 64 and as Andrews.
And that was because we agreed to take over Oak, but not 12th and 13th.
I just had no understanding that this conversation for 12th and 13th even took place, a year ago.
Yeah. Yeah. And the conversation about us taking it over jurisdictionally, we just had last week or the end of the week before, to solve this parklet problem. So we did broach the subject for sure. We talked about it. But the other thing I think that we discussed a little bit is that Oak, a good portion of Oak has already been redone through urban renewal. It was done not that long ago. So it's in really great shape. 12th and 13th, not as much. There's a lot of work that needs to be done up there. Not that urban renewal isn't going to do some of that work. But, just figuring out what it needs, how far behind it is in maintenance. I mean, there's a lot of things to try and figure out on 12th and 13th that we really couldn't do in a very short period of time where we needed to get this intergovernmental agreement ready for Oak. So it's just, it's a bigger project and the urban renewal involved and all that. So if council wants to keep discussing 12th and 13th, I think we just need to give staff that direction and there we can continue that discussion with ODOT about that process. Megan?
I would agree with
that. I guess just quickly while we're on it, is it more time or what would it entail to really figure out the 12th and 13th issue?
Yeah, it's more time and I think we'd want to have we have more concerns about the state of the roads up there. So we'd really want to make sure we were getting enough support from ODOT before we took that over.
Thank you.
Mark, and then Tim.
So I just want to put in my voice to support including 12th and 13th in this discussion, letting it continue. I think that as we do the visioning of that area, having us be more in control is going to be significantly advantageous to that process. I completely agree and understand that the time it takes to make the right deal and that there's a whole bunch of complexity is there. But if you're asking for my input on whether it's a good idea, I think in general, yes, I think it's going to be an important idea. So,
Okay. So I think I'm hearing, Tim, go ahead. Sorry, Tim.
Yeah, just briefly, I would also support the 12th and 13th discussion. And I guess my next question is, and maybe you're going to answer this, Kate. So this is like the first step. Is it like a negotiation from here, or this is just what it is, and then you draw up details? How does it proceed from here?
I think this is what's come through the negotiations stage, and it's just a matter of getting it finalized through the Transportation Commission.
So can you just briefly, Wade, discuss what the, you had mentioned that they want to keep freight moving through. Can you explain what that means, what their concern is here?
The biggest concern I saw was that they have the ability to occasionally move an oversized load with flagging. And that's, you know, yearly maybe. It's not very often.
And Counselor, I had some specific conversations with them about this issue, thinking it might come up, and also wanting to make sure that we knew exactly what we were signing up for. Mm-hmm. So Wade's correct. If we want to change that in the future, we just need to engage in a conversation. So we'd need more time to engage in a conversation about any changes to that. But we're agreeing to it now, kind of with that understanding.
That's exactly what I was looking for. Thank you.
And I think one of the things that I asked when we were having this little discussion with them is that, well, what if we wanted to close one block, say we wanted to close from Second to First on Oak, you know, potentially for several months or something like that during the summer. Is that possible? And they said, yes, it is. You know, if you controlled Oak, but as long as the traffic that came off of the interstate could get through, you know, they could go up to State and they would still be able to turn, and we didn't restrict things on State or the corner of Second and State. They said, yes, that's definitely a possibility if we had Oak in our jurisdiction. You know, there is some things that have to happen because of the interstate, but that's a possibility, is what they told us.
Yeah, I think there's a big distinction between temporary and permanent changes. I don't know how long temporary goes for, but certainly more flexible for a short-term traffic change than a long-term.
Additional questions? Jessica?
I was just going to add that in abundance of caution, of course, I've mentioned before that Slopeswell is attached to my husband and partners. But my interest in 12th and 13th, it's, you know, it's going to be way too late for a parklet this year, probably and it's been moved anyway. But my interest is more thinking ahead to the urban renewal issues and what we would like to do up there. So just wanted to make that statement.
Thanks. Additional questions or comments?
Well, we're here. I also think it's incredibly worthwhile to investigate what taking over 12th and 13th would look like, and if we could do it.
What would look like? What? Say that again.
Sorry, let me mumble it. what it would look like, what it would entail if we could do it, if it makes sense for the city.
12th and 13th. Okay. All right, I think we're getting head nods on continued discussions on 12th and 13th. Okay. All right, and for what we're doing right now, the second packet we got, there is a motion on page 103.
Yeah, I today realized that we should probably modify that a little bit.
Okay.
Because this is a draft version that's attached, Would you like me to read a modification?
Yeah, that would be great. If you could just read what the motion should be with the modification, that would be great.
Okay. I move to authorize the mayor to sign a final intergovernmental agreement with ODOT that is substantively similar to the draft version attached for transfer of Oak Street from Front Street to 13th to the City of Hood River.
Okay. Okay, that's the motion. Do I have anyone agreeing to make that motion?
Do we make that motion?
Okay, Jessica's made the motion.
I second.
Okay, let's see. Gladys, I guess I'll made the second on that. Thank you. Additional discussion? Okay, roll call vote. Megan?
Yes.
Jessica?
Aye.
Mark?
Yes.
Gladys?
Yes.
Tim?
Aye.
Eric?
Aye.
Chair votes yes. All right. We're going forward with that transfer. Thank you, everyone. Oh, it's a ODOT's a difficult animal to deal with, but we're getting there on some of these things. Thanks. Okay, we are done with regular business. Report from officers, department heads, announcements. Does anyone have anything? Chief Holste?
Nothing from the PD, Mayor.
Okay. Chief Damien?
Nothing from the fire department as well. Thank you.
Okay. And I don't see anyone else on. Planning Director Dustin isn't on tonight, correct? Okay.
No, all right. Dustin is excused.
Okay. Visitor Advisory Committee, Jessica and Megan. Anything?
Lost my mouse there. Just real quick, I think it's about the same as the last time, where they're still just trying to balance their outreach between, you know, wanting or needing visitors and also not really wanting to bring people to town with COVID. So there's been a lot of messaging on how to visit safely and responsibly. And I think they're trying, you know, they're walking the line as well as you can. And then the group has also been continuing conversations with the chamber on kind of a long-term collaboration. So.
Okay. Anything to add, Jessica?
Megan was our representative last meeting. I was not able to.
Okay. Great, thank you. So mayor call, and then we're gonna do council call. We're gonna do our equity and social inclusion resolution, which we went through last time, and we had the subcommittee take down all the notes, and then we'll go through that. So just a couple of things that I wanted to say. First of all, I mean, I think there'd been some perception that Gladys was not being supported. And I just wanted to say personally that I do support you, Gladys. I'm glad you're an important part of our council. I think that sometimes the public doesn't know that we do have conversations of support to each other behind the scenes that don't have anything to do with council business. and so I just want people to know that I just wanted to say that. There was also, I'm trying to make these meetings as close to real meetings when we're in person as possible. But it, you know, it's not 100% successful. And I guess that's one of the reasons that I did that roll call, because I know there are people that are on Zoom. Some of them can see us and some of them are on the phone. And so, you know, when we do our head nods, the people that are watching can see us, but the people that are on the phone don't have a clue what we're doing. And I call on people as I see them raise their hand. Sometimes I see someone unmute and then I call on them because I see they're just unmuted and they haven't raised their hand yet. So I'm just trying to watch what's going on the screen quite a bit with that. So I'm just trying, this is for council's information and for the public's information that have, you know, sent some messages about not sure we're doing this, not sure we're doing that. The other thing is, we have never, since we started these Zoom meetings, had the chat feature turned on. So we as counselors cannot chat individually with each other during these meetings, or we cannot have someone else chat with us on Zoom. And I expect that we are all, you know, paying attention as we always do in our in-person meetings. We're not texting people. We're not looking at our phone. We're not checking our emails. And getting information from other people during the meetings that might have something to do with the meetings. I trust our council is doing everything just like we would do if we were in an in-person meeting. So I've had, you know, some people saying that they weren't sure if that was happening. And I just wanted to say that publicly, that's what I expect. And that's what I expect everyone is already doing. I trust everyone here that is, we're holding our meetings correctly. I think that's all I have for council, for mayor call. Let's do our resolution next, and then we'll do everyone else's council call after we get through our resolution. So we have a new version. So I don't know if the subcommittee wants to talk about those changes, Megan or Tim.
Go ahead. I'll just jump in. So we incorporated all the changes we'd gotten at the last meeting, and then also had done some work to kind of tighten up language and attempt to shorten a bit more, while keeping the same, thoughts and direction. There shouldn't really be any substantial changes beyond what the council had talked about last meeting. But I guess if anyone sees anything, let us know.
Yeah, I looked at it. I had taken notes, and you'd sent the changes to me before we sent it out to council, and I had the exact same information that I took down during the meeting. So I think you guys caught everything and consolidated some things, which made it easier to read. Additional comments from anyone on what we have? All right, I'm trying to find where we have this. I've got two versions of my packet here, so I'm trying to find everything on both of these. Hold on. What I'm trying to find is, if anyone knows where it calls for the motion on the resolution, we can go ahead with that. Or if there isn't any,
yeah, it would just be a motion to approve or adopt the resolution for racial and social equity within the city of Hood River, effective July.
Okay. Okay, and it's resolution 2020-13.
Well, seems fitting that I should make the motion. Sorry, Councillor Saunders. This one's mine. So I make a motion to approve resolution 2020-13 for racial and social equity submitted to the subcommittee for consideration at council.
Well, I will gladly second you, Gladys.
Okay, we have a motion from Gladys and a second from Megan to adopt Hood River City Council resolution 2020-13. Resolution for racial and social equity within the city of Hood River. Roll call, Megan?
Yes.
Tim?
Aye.
Jessica?
Aye.
Gladys?
Yes.
Eric?
Aye.
Mark?
Yes.
And chair votes aye. Good job, everyone. Thank you for all that work on that. I think it's very important and timely to have this right now. That's great. Thank you. We're not going to put it in a drawer. Let's just say that we're not putting it in a drawer. it's a working document that we just need to incorporate it into the things that we're working on as a city. So thank you so much. Now council call. Megan?
I don't think I have anything else. Mostly just been trying to stay above water with work. So nice to see you all.
Thanks, Megan. Jessica?
Thank you, Mayor. I was also just gonna chime in that it was mostly just a lack of recognition that it was the point to jump into the conversation last time when Councilor Rivera made her statement, but it was definitely not an omission for any specific reason. I have privately supported Councilor Rivera and also publicly support her and standing up against people that would potentially want her off the council. I recognize we all, you know, we get contacted by people that, anyway, that's all I'm gonna say. And I would just wanna remind folks that we do have, not necessarily through council, but through work, we have a grant program for businesses and nonprofits that were impacted by COVID and have not accessed the federal funds, and we still have a lot of money available. We've set August 13th as a deadline because otherwise then we're gonna have to give the money back to the state of Oregon. So if you, mced.org/bizgrants, B-I-Z grants. Thank you.
Thanks, Mark.
Okay, thanks. I too, Gladys, appreciate your strong voice for these things, and it helped push this resolution and the other study. And for people that are looking for some other symbol, signal. I think this is the time when in the meeting when we can do it. So I appreciate that. You bring a voice that some, I don't have. So I think it's important, and together we're a good melting pot of this community. So we'll be stronger for it. I also want to, recognize, Rachel sent the work plan status thing to us an email today. And I think that's important too, is that we are finding ways for these things to be supported by our, how she's driving our big ship of city government. And I think it's important to see how all these pieces work together and appreciate the work that the city staff is doing every day to do the plan that we want. And I think that, that this resolution and the police work are all consistent with what we had said we were going to do in that January meeting. And so I think that it does mesh nicely and look forward to next year's thing where we ask ourselves what the next pieces are. Other than that, it's warm in my upstairs office. And I'll be glad we're almost done with this meeting, but thanks to all of you.
Thanks. Eric?
So next week, or I should say the next meeting in 2 weeks, I may either be late or possibly not in attendance. I'm sorry, I haven't missed a meeting yet, but I have to travel down to Coos County, Oregon, and will be, I'll just be there. I'm gonna try to make it, but don't wait for me if I'm not quite on time.
Okay, thanks for letting us know, Eric. Gladys?
Yeah, thank you to all of you. I too want to just chime in that a majority of you called me and supported me privately. But I think during our conversation, we did all come to the agreement that I really did feel like I needed support that day and I did not get it. So I just want to acknowledge that, and I want to acknowledge you all for acknowledging that as well. I just want to talk about a couple things. First of all, COVID-19 is disproportionately affecting our community. And of the 3,000 tests that have been done here in the area, we know that about 70% of those that have came back positive have been within our Latino Hispanic group, our low income, our Native American, It's affecting our most vulnerable, and we know that this pandemic is simply highlighting these social inequities. It's important that we all continue to wear our masks when, you know, now the regulations have changed, so it's indoor and outdoor use. Please, please wear your mask. That is what you can do to help protect me, to protect your neighbor, to protect your family members when you go out by wearing a mask. That is how you reduce the risk of you getting COVID or possibly giving it to someone else. It's important that you wash your hands. It's important that you try and maintain physical distance of 6 feet, if not possible. Having your mask will definitely help reduce the risk of you having COVID-19. And most importantly, if you are feeling sick, any of the following symptoms of COVID, to please call your primary care provider and seek treatment. There are many agencies that are offering free health care if that is what is needed. For example, One Community Health has been amazing, and our community has really stepped up during this need for our community, during this time for our community. You can also contact the County Health Department. They can help you figure out masks, hand sanitizers, so forth. Also, the next door is great. In regards to helping connect people to resources such as businesses, who we put in contact with Jessica and her organization. The other thing I want to talk about is that we are at a point in our country, in our community, where we simply need change. And people are opting out of vital conversations about diversity and inclusivity because they fear looking wrong, saying something wrong, or simply just being wrong. We choosing our comfort over difficult conversations is the epitome of privilege, and we have to have these conversations. If we don't, it corrodes trust and moves us away from meaningful and lasting change. We must show by example and lead through this discomfort, because I know I sure do. We all must get in the habit of speaking out. When you see something that's wrong, something that's not fair, you have the moral obligation to say something, to do something. We're at a point in our times where we must dismantle the system, these symptoms that were intentionally put in place to hold certain groups back. I know that my kids, my three brown kids, are going to look back and they're going to ask me questions of, Mama, what did you do? And Mama, what did you say? And I know that I can tell them, well, I ran for office to make those changes. And so for those people, Black, Indigenous, people of color out in our community, the time to step up, the time to be the change is now. And so I hope that there will be more Latino, Indigenous, people of color, their names on the November ballot. Join me. Join me at this table, because it cannot just be me. I need other people who look like me, who speak like me, who reflect the community that we're trying to serve. So I ask of you to be brave and to take that step and to put your name into the bucket so that you too can be here as well. Thank you.
Thanks, Gladys. Tim?
Thanks, Gladys.
Well, I guess first of all, I want to thank you, Mayor, for the job that you've done running these meetings and the transition to this electronic format, which has not been an easy one for any of us. And I think you've done a great job, honestly, of making that transition. And kudos to Rachel and all the other folks that make these electronic meetings go so smoothly. And I think that all of us have been in electronic meetings that don't go so smoothly. So these are, you know, I think, given all the potential things that could go wrong and all the difficulties associated with running a meeting this way, I think you've done an excellent job. So I just wanted to say that.
Thanks, Tim.
Yep. And Gladys, you know, you have my full support. I know that you won't be ruled by fear. I know that I won't be ruled by fear, and I have the utmost confidence that each and every one of the other counselors will not be ruled by fear. And so to those that think that they can affect us through fear, I'm just going to say, no, you cannot rule us by fear. Thanks.
Thank you, right. Tim.
Thank you, everyone. I think that's it for this evening. So we will see you back here in 2 weeks. And I think that's all for this evening. Appreciate it, everyone.
Have a good night, everyone.
We are adjourned at 8:34. Thank you.